Okay, so let's continue on the, this time we're going to go back again. We'll go back to the student that we skipped yesterday and have a look at that. This is, am I going to continue on the idea of right and friendship? And I want to have a little bit of a look at sensual desires. I've run this week as all about sensual desires and sensual pleasures and sensual objects and this kind of stuff. Before I do that, I just might just make the point again that the primary thing, the most important thing on the Buddhist path to deal with is always ill will and that sort of thing. Yeah. Because it is, as we said before, it's far more harmful in terms of karma, in terms of relationships, in terms of everything. Yeah. And also, it's much easier to deal with. Sense of pleasure is much more, takes much more commitment and perseverance to deal with. So please keep that in mind to get your priorities right. Otherwise, you can kind of feel that you get really stuck. And then you kind of lose heart and you kind of stop practicing as a consequence sometimes. But still, I think it's good to have a look at sensual pleasures because it is an important part of the Buddhist path. And there are some nice insights and some nice understanding that I think kind of broaden out your horizons and make you look at the world in a slightly different way. And just that idea of getting a slightly different view of things. Once the view changes, other things tend to kind of fall into line as a consequence of the right view, the right outlook. This is why it can be quite useful. So this particular sutta is the Buddha in a discussion with a man called Potalya. And this man, Potalya, he thinks that he is an ascetic. So he kind of wanders around and takes himself quite seriously. And the Buddha points out that actually you haven't really given up enough to be called an ascetic. And then he brings out these similes of the danger in sensual pleasures to show him kind of the sort of things that he has to give up further to become a true ascetic from the Buddhist point of view. And these are the similes that I want to have a look at, that where the Buddha brings these things out. There's 7 similes altogether, and I will discuss these and hopefully be able to bring out some of the meaning of what these are about. So this is what the Buddha has to say. Householder, right? He's not happy when he's called a householder, this man. He's really upset about that. Because he thinks, I'm the real ascetic. I don't want to be called householder. Anyway, householder, suppose a dog overcome by hunger and weakness was waiting by a butcher's shop. Then a steel butcher or his apprentice would toss the dog a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood. What do you think, householder? Would that dog get rid of his hunger and weakness by gnawing such a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that was a skeleton of well-hacked, clean-hacked, meatless bones smeared with blood. Eventually that dog would reap weariness and disappointment. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a skeleton by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much danger, much despair, while the danger in them is great. So the first thing to keep in mind here again, as I mentioned briefly before, is the idea that in Pali the word for sensual pleasures is karma. Not kamma. Kamma means action, but karma. Karma has 2 aspects to it. And one aspect is the kind of the personal desire, the desire for things. That is called karma. But also all the objects in the world that we desire, they're also called karma. One is usually in the singular, one is normally in the plural. And when you think about both of these aspects, that's when the assemblies really come out properly. So the skeleton, right, that is thrown to that dog, which is basically just bones or whatever. These are obviously like the objects in the world that we're always seeking for. So this is what is happening here. So here you have this dog, right? The dog is really hungry and weary and trying to kind of find some kind of satisfaction. That's what this dog is trying, right? he tries to find satisfaction, but he only reaps weariness and disappointment. And so the problem here is that this dog is running around to the butcher shop. He waits outside the butcher shop. He thinks the butcher would throw me some nice meat. But meat is valuable. They're not going to throw expensive meat to a dog. So because of that, you take all as much meat as you possibly can. and all that is left is this bone with a little bit of blood on it. Yeah, and the dog gets the bone, and you kind of taste, it tastes nice. You get the taste of blood, right? It tastes a bit like meat. But there's no satisfaction there. It doesn't allay the problem. It doesn't allay the craving. The craving is almost as strong as it was before. All we get is this taste, something that seems delicious. Yeah, and then, of course, the dog runs on to the next butcher shop. And when it runs on to the next butcher shop, exactly the same thing happens again. The craving doesn't really disappear. There's no real satisfaction. There's no sense of contentment there. No sense of completion. The itch, that drive, is just as strong as it was before. The drive hasn't really settled. And so that dog keeps on running and running and running from butcher shop to butcher shop. And it does this in this life. And then it dies and it continues in the next life because it doesn't really see that there is a problem with the actual behavior with the behavior itself. And this is a kind of a very stark thing, right? It's eternal running around, running after something. Something which always is over the horizon. Something always out of reach. You think you can get there. You think it will give satisfaction. But when you get there, it's still a little bit over the horizon. So you keep on running. Craving tells you if you get the object that you are craving for, you will be satisfied. But when you get the object, you're not really satisfied. And craving re-arises again, just as strongly as before, sometimes even more strongly, precisely because it wasn't as satisfying as you thought it would be. So always this continual running after things, always over the horizon. And when you see that, it's kind of scary, yeah? It's kind of scary because we're running after something we can never reach. But we keep on running because we're blind. We don't realize that there actually is a solution to this problem. Because we don't realize there is a solution, we don't search for the solution. But of course there is a solution, and that is the whole point in it. So once you understand that this kind of eternal running around for things that will never satisfy you, and you will keep on running, and this ties you down to samsara, you're always looking into the future, never being satisfied in the present moment, you turn your mind to something else. And what you turn your mind to are those things that actually give satisfaction in the present moment. The craving dies down, and you feel right here, right now, you feel content, you feel happy, you feel satisfied, the itch is gone, the problem is gone. And you think, wow, this is it. This is what I was looking for all along. This is what the craving was promising me. Craving was promising satisfaction. I turned in a different direction, and when I turn in a different direction, that is where I found true satisfaction. That is where I found completion. That's where I found this whole, this emptiness, this bad emptiness, it's not the good emptiness of the Buddha, but the bad emptiness, the hollowness inside, suddenly has been filled in there. And there is no more craving and desire there. And where do you find that? You find it by finding it in the, by pursuing spiritual happiness. Yeah, every time you do an act of kindness that makes you feel happy, check out that happiness. If you do an act of generosity, feel what a happiness feels like that you get from those spiritual kind of acts. And you will see it is very different from the worldly type of happiness. It is a satisfying happiness. It doesn't lead to more craving. Rather, it leads to satisfaction and completion in the present moment. And this is what is so beautiful, and this is a distinction between the spiritual happiness of the Buddhist path on the one hand, and the craving and the worldly happiness. It's not really happiness. It's just this urge driving you forward. You are like a slave. The distinction between those two. And then one day, as you practice this path, you deepen that sense of completion, satisfaction, of contentment. One day, you get into a deep state of samadhi. And one day, for the first time in perhaps your entire life, that craving is completely gone. You're perfectly happy, perfectly satisfied in the present moment. Here, the present moment feels complete. There is nothing missing anymore. In your entire life, something has been missing. Even after you were running after some sensual pleasures and you felt happy for a short while, still, you didn't really feel complete. There was still a kind of a hollowness there, yeah? But for the first time in your life, you get into a deep state of samadhi, you feel completely satisfied. Nothing is missing. The craving is completely gone. And you realize you have finally reached that goal that you were searching for all along. This is what you really wanted. Yeah? Now you see where it is. And this is why, and this is kind of one of those powerful insights that you get on the Buddhist path, is that you realize, actually, now you have found the answer to the meaning of life. The meaning of life is the question of the meaning of life, right? What is the meaning of life? Well, obviously, if we have all these desires inside of us, we're always moving towards something here. The meaning must be to satisfy that so you feel complete, yeah? That must be the meaning, because that's the drive. That drives everything we do in life. From the moment you get up in the morning to you go to bed, almost everything you do is driven by the sense that you want to go somewhere, you want to reach some kind of satisfaction. And now, for the first time, you have found that. And it feels like, yeah, this is the whole point. It feels like you have reached kind of the answer to the question of the meaning of life. That is kind of the whole point of this. And then you think, this is it. No more drive. Nowhere else to go. I could sit here forever and there would be no problem. Yeah, because when satisfaction is complete, when there's no more desire in your mind, then of course you can just stay there. There's nothing more worth doing in the whole world. So that is what samadhi actually gives you when it becomes really deep and really profound. And it is not the full end of the path, because the end of the path, of course, goes beyond that. And the reason is because eventually that samadhi, it evaporates again, you lose that samadhi, and then you actually have to then have the insight as well to understand the conditioned nature also of the samadhi and everything else. And as you do that, you can gain the kind of perfect satisfaction that never leaves you as a consequence. So this kind of goes for the, you know, all the way to the end of the path in that sense. But already, when you have that first experience of samadhi, you know that you are in the presence of the very answer to the meaning of life. Very powerful, right? What else are you going to do? If you have found something that is going to give you the answer to the meaning of life, what else are you going to do in your life? Are you going to do that? You're going to do something else and waste your time, right? And this is really the thing. Once you feel that you have found the answer to the question of the meaning of life, you can't do anything else. You have to commit yourself 100%. Because there is no, this is all that matters. And this is, of course, why once you become a stream mentor and all of these things, you are 100% committed to that path. No turning back, one direction only, heading for nirvana. And that's really it. There you are. This is the simile of the hungry dog, always running after the bones. And if you get that simile, then you can see how actually it is quite terrible in a sense, right? It's quite kind of this eternal running. It just sounds like something actually quite like, almost like some kind of horror movie almost. Running, never actually getting anywhere. Anyway. Let's go on to the next one. Householder, suppose a vulture, a heron, or a hawk sees the piece of meat and flew away, and then other vultures, herons, and hawks pursued it, pecked and clawed it. What do you think, householder? If that vulture, heron, or hawk does not quickly let go of that piece of meat, wouldn't it incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers us. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a piece of meat by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. Yeah, and this here is about, if you like, the competition over these objects, sensual objects of the world. We're always competing over things. The pie is only so large, the economy is only so big, everybody can only have so much. Yeah, so we compete over things. Of course, one of the great things that we compete over, one of the biggest ones, is like a partner in life. You know, many people want the same person, that's often the problem. And then we compete, and that's of course a major problem. And one of perhaps the biggest problems in human life is precisely that. Because we attach to people, and then when they leave, or somebody else takes them over, whatever, it causes tremendous suffering in people. But it's not just limited to that. It is, of course, in so many areas we compete. We compete economically. Our whole economy is based on the idea of competition. Yeah, the capitalist economy is all about competing against each other. You can see how that entire economic structure causes pain, causes problems. because one person loses out, another person wins, etc. And it creates kind of this kind of force trying to tear something out of you. This is not really meant as a criticism of capitalism. I'm kind of not into that kind of criticizing political systems as such. But you can see how there is almost an inherent problem there, yeah? When there is competition, there's always going to be winners and losers, and there's going to be people who suffer as a consequence. So this is life. Then, you know, when you come to the end of your life, you have the inheritance from your previous generation, and then you fight over the inheritance. Sometimes the larger the inheritance is, the more people fight over what the last generation left behind. You see this sometimes, you read about this in the papers, and sometimes you may know people like that as well. And massive inheritance, and then they fight over it, and they kind of never talk to each other for the rest of their life. It's terrible, right? It's crazy. It's complete madness. You're throwing out real happiness for some kind of artificial happiness that you can be had through these things. So this is, I think, one of the inherent problems with sensual pleasures. It always tends to lead to conflict down the road, one way or another. Conflict is an inherent part of this whole thing. Violence, wars, all of that comes out of the problem of sensual pleasures. If your pleasure is entirely eternal to yourself, and it's built up out of kindness and goodness in the world, there is no conflict with that kind of pleasure. Because it has nothing to do with the external world. In fact, it has to do precisely with the letting go of the external world. It's a perfectly personal pleasure, which is completely liberated from all of that. So this is a problem, a major problem, and inherent in sensuality is the idea of violence and conflict and problems. And once you realize that these two are so closely linked to each other, again, it becomes like very unfortunate, right? It becomes almost kind of repulsive in a sense. This does not mean that you cannot overcome a lot of anger and ill will without abandoning sensual pleasures. You still can reduce it a lot, but there will always be a residue. There will always be some limit to how far you can go. To some extent, search for sensuality, sensual desires, to some extent, it will always go with the opposite side, which is anger, negativity, ill will, and all of these kind of things. So that is the simile of the piece of meat. And what I would like to do is to have a look at a couple of other suttas that kind of bring out this in quite a nice way. So if you move one sutta ahead, one sutta forward, and this is from an extract from the Sakkapanya Sutta. This is the sutta I mentioned before where the heavenly musician, the Gandhava, Panchasika, he comes down to the Buddha and plays a love song to the Buddha. This is that same sutta. This is an extract from that sutta. Yeah, so this gives you a little bit more fleshing out of why sensual pleasures always inherently also involve some kind of conflict and problem. So, Sakka, the ruler of the gods, he has just been invited to ask a question of the Buddha. And this is then what he says. By what fetters, sir, a fetter is like a bond, right, that finds you. By what fetters, sir, are beings bound? Gods, humans, asuras, nagas, gandhavas, or whatever kinds, or whatever other kinds there may be, whereby, although they wish to live without hate, without harming, without hostility, without malignity, and in peace, yet they live in hate, harming one another, hostile and malign. Yeah, and this is kind of the thing. This is what is so interesting. We all wish to live in peace, and yet somehow we can't seem to do it. Why is that? It's a very interesting question here. This was Sakka's first question to the Lord, and the Lord replied, "Ruler of the gods, it is the bonds of jealousy and avarice that binds beings so that though they wish to live without hate, etc., they do yet live in hate, harming one another, hostile and malign." So jealousy and avarice, you can see why that is the case, right? Jealousy is, of course, a very powerful driver in human life, and very often it leads to all of these things, you know, the crimes of passion that we hear about, and when, you know, which are kind of crimes within the family and within people who are very close to each other. Avarice just means being stingy, holding on to things, you know, grasping onto your own stuff. That too, of course, if you have a very strong grasping tendency, then again, it will often lead to violence as a consequence. Because often, again, you have to compete over these things. Other people take it or whatever it has. So that is the first one, and it kind of makes good sense, yeah? Especially this idea of jealousy, because it is often very personal, and it has to do with relationships to other people, so it can be very powerful forces in the human mind there. Then Sakka, having expressed his appreciation, asked another question there. But sir, what gives rise to jealousy and avarice? What is their origin? How are they born? How do they arise? Owing to the presence of what do they arise? Owing to the absence of what do they not arise? Jealousy and avarice, ruler of the gods, take rise from like and dislike. That is their origin. That is how they're born, how they arise. When these are present, they arise. When these are absent, they do not arise. Yeah, like and dislike. This is exactly what we're talking about before in the sense restraint formula. Right? The abhidha dominasa, the attraction to things and the aversion towards things, the liking of things and the disliking of things. When you like certain things, you hold on to them, you attach to them, and then jealousy arises if somebody else wants to take it away. You attach to them, so avarice arises. You want to hold on to it. You grasp onto these things. So like and dislike always lead to powerful attachments. This is what you see in the suttas. You see the dependent arising. It has a vedana paccaya tanha. Vedana, feeling, is a condition for craving. Tanha paccaya upadana. Craving is a condition for upadana, which is like grasping, holding on to things, attachment. Whenever there is craving, desire, there will be attachment as a consequence. That's really what he is saying here. Okay. But sir, what gives rise to like and dislike? Owing to the presence of what do they arise? Owing to the absence of what do they not arise? They arise, ruler of the gods, from desire. Owing to the presence of the desire, they arise. Owing to the absence of the desire, they do not arise. The desire, tanha here again, is a basic thing. And this, of course, kama tanha, the desire in the sensual realm, is the main manifestation of that, the most important one. And this whole thing then arises out of that. So here, the Buddha is showing you in a few steps how from desire, it always leads to all of these problems, right? Hate, harming, hostility, lack of living in peace, even though we don't want these things. Nobody wants these things. We all want to kind of live together in peace and harmony, yet we can't. And the reason why we can't is because desire is the root problem. As long as there is desire, these things are unavoidable. And that is why sometimes, you know, you look out into the world and we're all kind of seeking to find solutions to the world problems. But really, the problem is, from a Buddhist point of view, that the root causes are so deep in the human psyche that it probably is impossible to overcome wars completely just through policy, just through acting in the right way. You have to turn in a completely different direction. And that direction is towards ending that desire. And of course, the only desire you can really end in the world is your own desire. You can't go out and end the desires of all other people. That's never going to happen, probably. So you focus on yourself, and then you hope that maybe some other people also will be inspired by that. They will see that that actually is the right way of overcoming all of these issues that are out there. So let's, the second one, the next discourse here, this is Digha Nikaya 15, makes a very similar kind of point. This is also a very nice sutta, the Mahanidana Sutta. It's a long discourse really on dependent origination, but as part of that dependent origination, it does a few detours and shows you a few other kind of conditionalities as part of that. Very similar to the previous one, just a slightly different take on that. And so, Ananda, feeling conditions craving. Craving conditions seeking. seeking conditions acquisition here. Acquisition conditions decision making here. Decision making conditions lustful desire. Lustful desire conditions attachment. Attachment conditions appropriation. Appropriation considers avarice. You've got avarice again there. Avarice conditions guarding of possessions. And because of the guarding of possessions, they arise with taking up of stick and swords, quarrels, disputes, arguments, strife, abuse, lying, and other bad, unwholesome qualities. So again, this idea that all of these things, here is a bit more complicated sequence. I'm not sure exactly why it is so complicated, but you can see all these various mental aspects. And eventually, from craving, arises all of these kind of problems, all the social problems in the world. So, there you are. So let's go back to the main sutta again. And that is the simile of the hawk. Next simile. Householder, suppose a man took a blazing glass torch and went against the wind. What do you think, householder? If that man does not quickly let go of that blazing glass torch, wouldn't that blazing glass torch burn his hand or his arm or some other part of his body, so he might incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, the noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures or sensual objects have been compared to a glass torch by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So a glass torch, yeah? A glass torch is something that you use to kind of give you light, so it has a certain purpose. Yeah, it gives you a little bit of happiness because you can see where you walk, you don't have to stumble, that kind of thing. It avoids a little bit of suffering, perhaps. But of course, then once the wind comes, because it's grass, all the embers come back on you, and they burn you. In the same way, sensual pleasures also provide you with a little bit of happiness. Yeah, but as soon as you take them up, as soon as you crave for them and you start pursuing them, you start attaching to them. And as soon as you start attaching to these things, you are saying, basically, please allow me to suffer. Why? Because once you attach to something, you know it's going to have to be taken away from you sooner or later. And then the pain arises when those things that you're attached to actually get taken away. This is one way in which kind of these things are problematic, yeah? And of course, once you are attached to something, there's always that underlying fear there. The underlying fear, this is going to disappear. You know, is my partner, are they really being faithful to me? Are they maybe interested in somebody else? That underlying uncertainty is always going to be there. Even if it's very small, there's going to be that niggling feeling there sometimes that things aren't quite right. Or you leave your house, right? You come back after being on a nice retreat here, and then some burglar has been through your house. It's possible. It is conceivable. Yeah. And of course, again, that niggling feeling, maybe that makes you uncertain about your being here on the retreat even. It is kind of a small possibility that these things may happen. So this is what is going on here. So this is one side of things. The other side of things is that as soon as you crave for something, the very feeling of craving is a feeling of dissatisfaction, the feeling of not being complete, the feeling that something is missing. Yeah, that's why we crave, because something is missing, something isn't quite right. So that very dissatisfaction that comes with craving is itself, if you like, a type of suffering that you have. So this is just a couple of ways that I think about this, but a blazing grass torch, right? A little bit of happiness, but a lot of potential problem arises from that. Next one. This is a really powerful one. And this next one, I have to warn you, is actually quite hard to understand because it is so against our ordinary way of looking at these things. So sometimes with these similes, when the Buddha kind of says something very strong, again, don't reject it, don't accept it. If you accept it, that's fine. If it kind of makes sense to you, no problem. But you don't force yourself to accept these things. Just reflect on them. And the way I think about these things, if the Buddha says something which is hard to understand, I think, well, let me put it aside for a while. But I won't reject it because of the faith and confidence I have in this teaching. So, this is how it goes up. Householders, suppose there were a charcoal pit deeper than a man's height, full of glowing coals, without flame or smoke. Then a man came who wanted to live and not to die, who wanted pleasure and recoiled from pain. And two strong men seized him by both arms and dragged him towards that charcoal pit. What do you think, householder? Would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, venerable sir, why is that? Because that man knows that if he falls into that charcoal pit, he will incur death and deadly suffering because of that. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a charcoal pit by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So, there you are. Sensual pleasures, right? That nice relationship, that nice new car you have, is a charcoal pit. And that's what the Buddha says here. It's pretty hard to see, isn't it? It's very difficult to see this. And this, of course, is why it is so. How can the Buddha say this? How can he go so far? You know, that beautiful, like, new BMW you have. I don't know if anyone you have BMW, nice BMW. Whoa, stay away. Charcoal pit. This is what the Buddha is saying here. It's kind of very hard to really get that or to grasp it. What a beautiful meal you're going to have. Yeah, wonderful meal, really delicious. No, actually, maybe it's a charcoal pit, that too, huh? So this is the issue here. How is it possible to see these things in this way? What is actually going on here? And the first thing is that the meal in itself, or the BMW in itself, or even the relationship in itself, are not really charcoal pits. The problem is how we relate to these things. Yeah. Even if you're an arahant, you can still have a meal, and you can still enjoy the meal. You don't hate the meal because you're an arahant, but you have a very different relationship to it. And it is in that relationship between the object and you, that is where the problem really arises. The craving, the attachment, that is what the problem actually is. So let's see what the Buddha has to say about this. And this is explained very nicely in another sutta called the Maghandeya Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 75. And I will read out this little passage here. I could have explained it, but it's nice to read out straight from the suttas what these things sound like in the Buddha's own words. This is what he has to say here. Suppose, Maghandeya, there was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the openings of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. Yeah, so this is a leper, right? And leper has all these worms and things, incredibly itchy, very, very kind of unpleasant illness that you have. It is so unpleasant that actually you decide to burn your body over an open fire. That's what cauterizing is. You're actually literally burning yourself. Yeah. And that sensation of burning is actually pleasant because of the itchiness and the terribleness of all those wounds and all that kind of thing. Yeah. That's what's happening here. That's the meaning of the word cauterizing. Then his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives bring a physician, a doctor, to treat him. The doctor would make medicine for him, and by means of that medicine, the man would be cured of his leprosy and would become well and happy, independent, master of himself, able to go where he likes. Then two strong men would seize him by both arms and drag him towards a burning charcoal pit. What do you think, Maghandeya? Would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, Master Gotama. Why is that? Because that fire is indeed painful to touch, hot and scorching. What do you think, Maghandeya? Is it only now that fire is painful to touch, hot and scorching? Or previously too, was that fire painful to touch, hot and scorching? Master Gotama, that fire is now painful to touch, hot and scorching. And previously too, that fire was painful to touch, hot and scorching. For when that man was a leper with sores and blister on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs of the opening of his wounds with his nails, that his faculties were impaired. Thus, though the fire was actually painful to touch, he acquired a mistaken perception of it as pleasant. So too, Magandhya, in the past, sensual pleasures were painful to touch, hot and scorching. In the future, sensual pleasures will be painful to touch, hot and scorching. And now, at present, sensual pleasures are painful to touch, hot and scorching. But these beings who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures, who are devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, who burn with fever for sensual pleasures, have faculties that are impaired. Thus, those sensual pleasures are actually painful to touch. They acquire a mistaken perception of them as pleasant. So there you are. This is this very kind of challenging simile by the Buddha. So this gives you an idea of why it is so hard to see it. It is so hard to see it because we have always been immersed in sensual pleasure. It's always been so much part of our existence. Our whole waking life, we're receiving objects through the senses, through the ears, through the eyes or whatever, always coming in, and we always choose between the things. We like them or we dislike them. It's a continuous process. We're so immersed in this world. We kind of have that leprosy, if you like, all the time. And we have never been free from that illness. Because we have never been free from that illness, or maybe we have it, maybe way, way back in the past sometime, because we've never been free of it, we have always had impaired senses, always a distorted outlook on reality, never seeing things according to reality. Only when you get out of these things, you move outside of this, and you gain a deeper state of samadhi or whatever, only then is it possible to see what is truly going on. It's like the fish in water, right? The famous symbol of the fish, or the tadpole in water, rather. As long as the tadpole is in the water, you have no idea what water is, because you're always part of you, always around you. It's only when that tadpole becomes a frog, jumps out of the water, only then is it possible to understand what water is all about. And exactly the same thing with sensual pleasures and samadhi on the Buddhist path. You have to step out of it, only then can you understand what is going on. So, I'm not saying these things to kind of scare you or anything like that. It's here in the suttas. This is how the Buddha talks about these things. And I just think it's very interesting to look at how the Buddha regards the world. And it gives you an idea of things. And if you can see this a little bit, even just a tiny bit, and I'm sure you probably can see a little bit what is going on here, it's kind of already moving you in that direction. And you get some understanding of what actually the Buddhist outlook on these things actually is. So please just take it as that and just reflect on it. All of these things are meant for reflection and consideration, and not for grasping onto in a blind kind of way. So that is the charcoal pit simile. And then we have the next one. Householder, suppose a man dreamt about lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely lakes. And on waking, he saw nothing of it. So too, householder, a noble disciple, considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a dream by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So sensual pleasures are like a dream. Why are they like a dream? And again, it's because they're always about the future. They're always about something else, something you haven't acquired, something that isn't real yet, somewhere you are moving to, something that's always slightly over the horizon. You haven't quite got there yet. It's something that you're thinking about. If I get that, if I move there, you desire this. Always about the future, some kind of state that you're trying to get to. And this is why it is a bit like a dream. And when you wake up, it says here, it's a bit like waking up, it's a bit like, when you actually get there, you actually realize also that it isn't as fulfilling as you thought it might have been originally. In this way, it is like a dream. Another way I like to think about this as a dream is to think of it, how you change through the different stages of your life. And I still, I remember, it's quite clear. You know, you remember when you're very young, you may be a teenager or in your early 20s, you go to university or you go to school and you think about your future. Yeah, and your future is so unrealistic. Yeah? I don't know if you remember that. So utterly unrealistic about what you think about life and all these things. You know, you think, yeah, I'm going to have a girlfriend like this, right? I'm going to have a girlfriend like this. Now I'm kind of walking around like this. It's completely, absolutely wrong. Completely, you know, absolute nonsense. Have a house like this, have a big, nice house, right? This is how I'm going to live. Now I live in a tiny little hut in the forest, yeah? Again, got it absolutely wrong. What a complete waste of time, that dreaming was. I'm going to have a career, right? This is going to be my career. I'm going to do these kind of things in my life. That certainly didn't work out, right? Completely different from what I thought it was going to be. So that dreaming, and it's the same for all of us. In my case, it's absolutely clearly, the difference is kind of really stark. But for all of us, these dreams are very, very often very far away from reality. How we think the world is going to be, kind of all rosy and beautiful and nice, the reality is so different from that. And then gradually we kind of reduce our dreams a little bit, right? Because we realize it's unrealistic. And sometimes we don't really see the fact that we are reducing the dream or changing the dream to become more realistic because it's a very gradual process. And because the process is so gradual, we never actually really noticed that dream we had originally was incredibly unrealistic. And 20 years later, you look at the situation in life, it is so different from what you thought it was going to be. So it's very useful sometimes to reflect back. What was my state of mind before? How did I look at these things before? And see that distinction there between reality and craving and desire moving forward. Yeah, this dream, and it's a nice metaphor. The more you kind of enter samadhi, the more you kind of get the spiritual happiness in the world, the more your mindfulness starts to arise, the less you dream, the more you come into real existence. And actually, it's very pleasant to really live, right? It's far preferable to have that mindfulness and be in the present moment than to have these dreams all the time. You start to feel alive. You start to feel that you're really here. You can really respond to things. You can really kind of take part in the here and now, rather than kind of living on some kind of false premises about the future. So I will leave you another nice sutta, which kind of drives home a little bit this point of the dream. And this is a sutta called the Samiddhi Sutta, and it's found in the Sanghutta Nikaya. And I always remember reading the sutta the first time, and I was a bit puzzled by it. I didn't quite understand what was going on. And it took me some time to kind of decipher or understand the deeper message behind it. So this is how it goes. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling in Rajagaha. Something has gone wrong with the printing there. Rajagaha is supposed to be here. The hot springs park. Then the Venerable Samiddhi, having risen at the first flush of dawn, went to the hot springs to bathe. Having bathed in the hot springs and come back out, he stood in one robe, drying his limbs. Then, when the night had advanced, a certain devata of stunning beauty, illuminating the entire hot springs, approached the Venerable Samiddhi. Having approached, stood in the air and addressed the Venerable Samiddhi in verse. Without having enjoyed, you seek alms, bhikkhu. You don't seek alms after you have enjoyed. First enjoy, bhikkhu, then seek alms. Don't let the time pass you by. I do not know what the time might be. The time is hidden and cannot be seen. Hence, without enjoying, I seek alms. Don't let the time pass me by. So here is this devata, this is almost like Mara in disguise, saying, yeah, forget about being a monk, you know, come and enjoy. Life is enjoyable, that's what you should be doing. But Samiddhi seems to be, understand that there is a problem here. Then that devata alighted on the earth and said to the Venerable Samiddhi, you have gone forth while young, bhikkhu, a lad with black hair, endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life, without having dallied with sensual pleasures, without having kind of enjoyed sensual pleasures. Enjoy human sensual pleasures, bhikkhu. Do not abandon what is directly visible in order to pursue what takes time. Yeah, and this is how it seems to many people, right? It's this idea that sensual pleasures, these are things we can have right now. It is available right here. You can go and have a nice meal. You can have a relationship with somebody. You can enjoy a movie. You can kind of do all of these things in the world. It's available right here and now. Whereas this path, right, this practice of meditation, whoa, it takes so much time. And it's kind of so much effort. And when is it going to give results? You know, who knows whether it's going to be in this life or the next life or whatever. It is so uncertain. So what this Devata is saying here, it kind of rings a bell for many people. It kind of hits many people's ideas about these things. But of course, the bhikkhu, he has a different idea. And he replies, I have not abandoned what is directly visible, friend, in order to pursue what takes time. I have abandoned what takes time in order to pursue what is directly visible. For the Blessed One, friend, has stated that sensual pleasures are time-consuming, full of suffering, full of despair, and the danger in them is still greater. While this Dhamma is directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see her, applicable to be personally experienced by the wise. So he is saying the exact opposite. So how is that possible? What is actually going on here? How can that be the case? First of all, who is right? Who do you think is right? The Deva or the Mahatma? I asked this question once. It was a large. I was giving a talk in Indonesia a couple of years ago. And there was like a large group of people there. And I asked this question to them. Who is right? The Deva or the Mahatma? And there was a young man on the front bench. Yeah, the Deva is right. The Deva is right. Everybody laughed, right? Because it was so kind of... So, and he was just joking as well, of course. But it was very funny here. So who is right? And it seems like, I mean, the natural feeling is that the Deva is right. Yes, the path kind of, when is it going to bear fruit? And this is why it is so interesting, because it is so kind of counterintuitive, right? It's a different way of looking at things. And of course, the reason why sensual pleasures always are time-consuming is because they are always about the future. They're always about something you can't quite reach, something always slightly over the horizon, something you're always pursuing, always running after it, never really getting there. That's why they are endlessly time-consuming. You never actually get there. The Dhamma, on the other hand, what is so powerful about the Dhamma is that if you practice the Dhamma right in this very moment, right, if in this moment you change your attitude from kind of being neutral to suddenly having a mind of loving kindness. If in this very moment you do an act of generosity, if in this moment you use your niso manasikara, wise attention, to change your attitude from whatever it is to something better, straight away you will feel the benefits of that. Straight away, right here and right now. The problem is that most of the time it's quite hard to make that change and use your niso manasikara. But if you are able to do it, you will feel how the Dhamma works in this present moment right away. And I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, sometimes you spontaneously do an act of kindness towards somebody. You do an act, you say something kind to somebody just because you want to be kind. And with that arises this happiness inside of you. You feel good about yourself. Yeah. So if you could do that at any time, turning your mind in the right direction, then straight away you feel the results of the Dhamma right here, right now. And of course, that happiness, as I've been saying that many times, is of a very different type from the sensual happiness. Because that happiness gives a sense of satisfaction and completion, a sense of fulfillment in the present moment. And that is why it is the happiness here and now. It is not time-consuming, nothing to do with craving. It is in the present moment. And that is why it works. So that is the difference here. And this is kind of the conundrum, right, which seems in some way so obvious, but actually, from a Buddhist point of view, it is the wrong way of looking at the world and the wrong way to understand happiness. Okay. So, that is the idea of the dream, sensual pleasures as a dream. Two more similes. Householder, suppose a man borrowed goods on loan, a fancy carriage and fine jeweled earrings, and preceded and surrounded by those goods, he went to the marketplace. And people seeing him would say, sirs, That is a rich man. That is how the rich enjoy their wealth. Then the owners, whenever they saw him, would take back their things. What do you think, householder? Would that be enough for that man to become dejected? Yes, venerable sir. Why is that? Because the owners took back their things. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Temporal pleasures have been compared to borrowed goods by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. Another beautiful simile that kind of has is very, very meaningful, and I've already been talking a lot about these things already. But of course, the point is here that everything in your life, you have to give it up sooner or later. It all has to go. Yeah, so much of it. We talked about all of these things before that you have to give up. Even parts of your identity are tied to this world right here and now. And it has to go when you pass away, when you move on into another existence. So it's all borrowed stuff. Yeah, it's all borrowed. You feel, this is the problem in life. We feel like we own these things. We feel like they are ours to keep. This is my relationship. This is my things. This is my career. This is my body. Yeah? Everything is ours. And we feel that we should kind of control these things. But the reality, as the Buddha says, all of these things are borrowed. They have to be given back. They have to be given back to what? They have to be given back to nature. Nature reclaims all of these things sooner or later. And that is the problem. It's a beautiful way of thinking about your things. And if you start to think about everything in this life as borrowed goods, you don't hold on to it so much anymore. Yeah, you don't grasp onto it. Just as in the same way, if you borrow something from a friend, you never really think of it as yours because you know you're going to have to give it back. So if you think about everything in life as things that you have borrowed from somebody, that has to be given back again, you don't attach so much because you understand it has to go back. At the very latest, it has to go back when you die. Very often, it has to go back before that. And one of the powerful things that this kind of contemplation does to you is that it makes you change how you invest your time and how you invest your resources in this life. Instead of investing everything in borrowed goods, instead of investing everything in this tiny little lifespan we have right here, and then having to give it all up when you die. This is what I was saying yesterday. Many people, I think one of the reasons why they are so confused and why they are so despairing when they die, is suddenly they realize, I've invested everything in this life. And now everything I have done is like wasted. Yeah, I have to leave it all behind. I've spent all my time doing things that I can't take with me into the future. Now I have to give it all up. And you feel, what was the point? I kind of wasted the opportunity. That's what it feels like, yes. It's kind of obvious when you look at it from that point of view. And very often, of course, the problem is that if you have no idea of rebirth, no idea of a future life, it doesn't make any sense to kind of invest for the future. It's only when you have an idea of a continued existence, that idea of investing beyond this life actually starts to make sense. So the question is, how much of your energy, how much of your time should you invest in something which is so limited? And how much of your energy and time should you invest in this much broader picture? This broader picture of moving on in samsara, perhaps for many, many lifetimes in the future, and hopefully, eventually, we can make an end of all of this. It changes your way of your ideas of what is important in life. And of course, the things that you should, the way to invest in the bigger picture is to invest in the spiritual path. Very often, it doesn't mean that we don't necessarily have to change our lives all that much, because it's all in the attitude, yeah? It's how we live rather than what we do that really matters. So what we do can have a little bit of impact, but the how is far, far more important. You can have a family life, and if you live your family life well, if you live it with the right attitude in the right way, it will be a spiritual path for you. Or you can live it badly, and it will have absolutely no spiritual effect at all. So everything is how we use these things. And just by changing the how, then you're actually investing for the future rather than investing just for this particular life. So this kind of big switch in how we look at things, yeah? And this is kind of how this comes about. So remember that. Everything in this life is like borrowed goods. And make sure you invest in those things that really, really matter. So very quickly, I'm going to have a look at the very last simile as well then. Householders, suppose there were a dense grove not far from some village or town, within which there was a tree laden with fruit, but none of its fruit had fallen to the ground. Then a man needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit, and he entered the grove and saw the tree laden with fruit. And he thought, this tree is laden with fruit, but none of its fruit has fallen to the ground. I know how to climb a tree. Let me climb this tree, eat as much fruit as I can, and fill my bag. And he did so. Then a second man came, needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit, and taking a sharp axe, he too entered the grove, and saw that tree laden with fruit. Then he thought, this tree is laden with fruit, but none of its fruit has fallen to the ground. I do not know how to climb a tree, so let me cut this tree down at its root, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag. And he did so. What do you think, householder? If that first man who had climbed the tree doesn't come down quickly, when the tree falls, wouldn't he break his hand or his foot or some other part of his body, so that he might incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to fruits on a tree by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, for the danger in them is great. So here, it is like a person wandering around in life, looking out for kind of the forest, probably the forest of the world, right? All the things when you wander around in the world, and you're looking around all the time for sensual pleasures. Where can I find some sensual pleasures in this world? And then when you find something nice eventually, you grasp hold of that, and you kind of climb that tree of sensual pleasures, and maybe that tree is full of mangoes, sweet mangoes, You go up there, and then you start eating it. And while you're eating this mango, this is like devouring sensual pleasures. While you're devouring the sensual pleasures, something happens, some danger happens. And if you are not careful, when that danger happens, somebody comes down to cut the tree. If you are intoxicated, and this is just another way of being intoxicated, if you are intoxicated with those sensual pleasures, you will not heed that danger. You will not come down from the tree. And because you don't, you will die and have serious problems as a consequence. So the sensual pleasures in the world are just like being intoxicated by the fruits of a tree. We are intoxicated. We forget what really matters. We forget how short-lasting these things are. We forget the kind of bigger picture. And because of that, we end up doing kind of silly things as a consequence. So this is another intoxication. We have been looking at the various kinds of intoxication. And all of these things are things that distort our outlook. So we forget what really matters. And we end up making all kinds of silly mistakes, practicing the wrong way, and doing all kinds of things, bad things, as a consequence. So that is the simile of the tree laden with fruit. I had to go through that a little bit quicker than I had intended, because time, as always, is running a little bit shorter, but there you are anyway. So that is all for this morning, so we'll see you again at 2 o'clock this afternoon.